You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with none other than Rod Bennett. Rod Bennett, the author of Four Witnesses. Rod Bennett, the author of The Apostasy That Wasn't. Rod Bennett,
all that good stuff.
Author of Chesterton's America. Rod Bennett, raconteur, famous.
The man, world, the myth. The legend.
Traveler. Southern gentleman.
Et cetera, et cetera. Out,
brewer of White Nut Lightning Whiskey.
Wait a minute now.
Hey, you live in the Smokies in Tennessee, you know?
So. Well, yeah, we you don't want to send the revenuers to my door, though, so careful.
All right. Okay. Damn Yankees.
How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing very well. Things are going well. I'm plowing ahead on a giant project right now, which
has Washington seceded from the Union yet?
No. California's been talking about that. I think Oregon wanted in on it too. Yeah, secession talk is always just crazy talk to me.
I'm used to Texans doing it, but. They used to speak rather ill of us around here for trying it, but now it's okay.
Well, you know, during the recent unpleasantness, it was it turned out to not be such a great thing. This is one of those things, you know, when I hear people talking about the Second Amendment and they tell me the reason that the founders put the Second Amendment in was so that you could start shooting at the government if you didn't like what they're doing. And I'm like, no, that was tried in 1861. And it really didn't work out. And in fact, it was tried earlier than that in the Whiskey Rebellion. And George Washington didn't approve of that interpretation of the Second Amendment either.
Right.
So,
well, let's just
say
you're going to need more than a Kentucky long rifle if you're going to match wits with the Army today.
Right. And, yes. If you're bringing a 48 caliber revolver to a drone fight,
kiloton nuke on the end of it.
Yeah, it's just it's not fated for
rather overmatched. And of course, the military would have divided up and settled the whole thing long before they ever got to your house. So, anyway, this is a subject for a different day. I don't think you wanted to talk about gun control today, Mark. Or maybe you did. I don't know.
Didn't want to. Well, you know, it does have to do a bit with our actual topic, which is apocalypses.
Right.
Apocalypses, both biblical and cinematic, because one of the many apocalyptic scenarios that people have, of course, is the, you know, the as you were mentioning earlier, somebody takes it into their head to secede from the Union. And, you know, one of the things that happens in war is what's called the fog of war. War plans are always complicated by the arrival of the enemy because they don't do things like they're supposed to do. And so wars spin out of control and bad things happen. And, you know, one thing leads to another, and nuclear bombs are dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which was not part of the original plan when they bombed Pearl Harbor. And so all of this feeds into apocalyptic fears. And when we hear the word apocalypse, we were talking about this yesterday with Michael Litchens, that when you hear the word apocalypse, you imagine hydrogen bombs or millions dead from some kind of virus, or millions turned into zombies by some kind of virus.
right.
Or, you know,
Bruce Willis trying to stop an asteroid.
Yes, Bruce Willis trying to stop an asteroid, or Martian tripod war machines marching.
Oh, that's a good one.
marching through New Jersey and trying to kill Tom Cruise. And
end of the world stuff. That's what apocalypse means to most people, is the end of the world. And
right.
I suppose it does involve that to some degree.
Well, it does involve the end of this world. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's interesting, we were talking about this yesterday, what's interesting is that Apocalypse, which is actually the Greek title of the book of Revelation, what it comes from, curiously, is it's the moment, it was the word used to describe the moment at which on a wedding night, bride and groom disrobe before one another and reveal themselves.
Wait a second. This is a family show, Mark.
This is a family show, but that's that's what we're.
It means an uncovering. Apocalypse means an uncovering, I think.
Yes. Yes.
The moment at which the bride and the bridegroom are introduced to each other in that particular way,
and revealed to one another,
involved in the Book of Revelation.
Right, because revelation means, of course, unveiling, something that is being revealed, something that has been hidden and is being revealed. And what's being revealed here? Well, what's being revealed here, of course, is the love of the bridegroom for the bride and of the bride for the bridegroom.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Reveal means to gain knowledge of, and this is how Adam and Eve's relations are described. Adam knew his wife Eve.
Isn't that interesting? That relationship in the sacrament of marriage. Greg Popcheck once remarked that the Eucharist is all the sacraments center around very simple and normal human activities, things that happen to us in day to day existence. So you got to wash up,
taking a bath.
Being alive, right, is taking a bath. Yeah. And so baptism is the sacrament of washing, among other things.
That's right.
And the Eucharist, of course, is the sacrament of eating. Mm-hmm. Marriage is the sacrament of sex. That's what marriage centers around, is that incredibly intimate way in which man and woman know each other, and through that act, as through the act of eating, as through the act of washing, God has made these things ways of access into his very life, the life of the Blessed Trinity. That's what the sacraments are about. And so man and wife are sacrament to one another. In the Western tradition, the priest doesn't marry you when you get married. The priest simply acts as witness. It's the husband and the wife who confer the sacrament on each other.
Right. Which is why you needn't be a Catholic to enter into a sacramental marriage, but you do have to be a baptized person.
You've got to be a baptized person, right. And so you become a sacrament to your spouse. Which is a huge and heavy duty, and as in the life of the Blessed Trinity, where the Father pours out the love to his love to the Son, and the Son reflects that love back to the Father, and in that love is the Holy Spirit, the third person of the Trinity. In the same way, in marriage, what happens is in the union of love between. In this one flesh union between husband and wife, a whole new eternal creature called your baby comes into existence.
Yep.
And it's an amazing thing. And it's this reflection
of the old Schoolhouse Rock. 3 is a magic number. You remember that one? Man and a woman have a little baby. Great. Classic stuff. And very sacramental. They mentioned the Trinity in it.
There you go. Uh-huh. So anyway, when we're talking about the apocalypse, what you see in the Book of Revelation, and what you see all through Scripture, is this nuptial dimension to the Christian faith. So Jesus reveals himself as the bridegroom. He calls himself that repeatedly. He compares the kingdom of heaven to a wedding feast. When you get to the book of John, you're just absolutely saturated in all this.
The guy is obsessed with sex.
Well, and he's obsessed with nuptial imagery, especially John, both in the Gospel of John and also in the book of Revelation. So in the Gospel of John, you begin just like the book of Genesis with the words "in the beginning," and then you count off 4 days. So John will say, you know, on the first day, you know, John the Baptist went here and did this. And then the next day, Jesus went here and did that. And the next day, this happened. And the next day, that happened. And then he suddenly says, on the third day, that's John's way of saying, pay attention, stupid. The third day is already extremely important in the Christian tradition. It's a word phrase that's really loaded, of course, because of the resurrection. But if you count that off, what he's just done is he's counted off 7 days. And so on the third day, which is to say day 7 of the creation week, Jesus was at a wedding. How about that?
About that.
And John's point is not, he's not going Dan Brown here on you. He's not saying that Jesus was the guy getting married, but rather he's saying that whoever was getting married at the wedding at Cana, they are the sacramental image of the bridegroom, who is Jesus. We'll continue this discussion when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Rod Bennett talking about apocalypses, both biblical and cinematic. And we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. If you want to join the conversation, we're talking about apocalypses, biblical and cinematic. And if you want to join the conversation, please give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. I talked to a guy today, by the way, who is, I am informed, a devoted listener of this show.
Really?
Yeah, and so it's, oh, so you're the one. Well, thank you. Yeah. anyway. So before the break, we were talking about this nuptial imagery that's all over in John's gospel. And so the first sign that Jesus performs, John calls it his first sign, and he means first not numerically, but in the sense of primacy, in the sense of, if you want to understand all the other signs and everything else that happens in this gospel, this is the sign you have to get first. This is the one that sets the paradigm for everything else that's going to follow in this gospel. I've mentioned this before, the best definition I've ever read of a gospel is, a gospel is a passion narrative with a really long introduction. and that's what's going on in John's gospel. So John starts with this sign, and it's a nuptial sign. He wants us to get that Jesus is the bridegroom, and that he's more than just the bridegroom. He is a Eucharistic bridegroom. So what sign does he do at a wedding? He turns water into wine. There's a wonderful little poem by a Catholic poet named Christopher Derrick that goes, he's a terror, that one. Turns water into wine, wine into blood. I wonder what he turns blood into. And anyway, you know, when you turn the page on John's gospel, you wind up with an interview with John the Baptist. And in the course of the interview, the whole conversation is nuptial. Okay. So John the Baptist goes, "I'm not the bridegroom. Jesus, over there in chapter 2, the guy at the wedding, he's the bridegroom." And then when you turn the page again on that gospel, you find Jesus is sitting at a well talking to the woman of Samaria. And wells turn out to be full of nuptial significance, particularly in the Old Testament. Why? Well, because they're symbols of life, fertility. It's not really hard to make that connection in a desert culture. a water source, that could be a symbol of life, you know.
I guess
And when you read the Old Testament, what you keep finding is, you know, so Abraham sends his servant off to go find a wife for Isaac. And he stops at a well. And there he meets Rebecca. Dun, dun. Ta-da!
Right.
And then Moses escapes from Egypt after he kills the Egyptian, and he goes to the land of Midian, and he's thirsty, and he stops at a well, and he meets Zipporah. Dun, dun, ta-da!
And am I right in remembering that the actual well in the Gospels is supposed to be Jacob's well?
Jacob's well.
It's supposed to be the same spot.
Well, it's the spot where Jacob sank a well. Different well than the one that
than in the Rebecca Abraham, story. Okay, all right.
Than in the Rebecca story, but it's a very ancient well already in Jesus's day, and it's in what had been the northern kingdom of Israel, which is now Samaria in Jesus's day, and he's talking to a Samaritan woman, and Samaritans are despised by Jews and despise Jews in turn, and the question is why? Well, moderns don't understand. It's just one of those ethnic things. The Middle East specializes in that stuff, so who knows? Well, it turns out we know why. There's this hostility between Jews, that is to say the inheritors of the southern kingdom of Judah. That's where the word Jew comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And the Samaritans, who are the people living in what had been at one time the northern part of Israel, and then after the Civil War, after the time of Solomon, had become a separate kingdom from the southern kingdom, which was ruled over by the house of David. That northern kingdom retained the name Israel. So Israel, 7 centuries before the time of Christ, had been completely conquered and swept out of existence by the Assyrian Empire. And the Assyrians, being smart conquerors, performed something which we today call ethnic cleansing. So they went into the northern kingdom of Israel, and they just deported almost everybody there and just sent them to the four winds. And then and that's where the 10 lost tribes of Israel come from, is from that moment in Israel's history. And so those 10 tribes of Israel vanish from history. We never hear from them again. And they go God knows where. They've recently done DNA studies and figured out that there is Israelite DNA scattered across the face of the earth, stretching from China to South Africa. So Israelites wound up a lot of different places. But where they never wound up ever again was Israel. And so they're lost to the tides of history. Well, what the Assyrians did after they deported all the Israelites was they imported 5 nations. You can read about this in 1 Kings, if memory serves. So they import 5 nations, and each one of those nations brings with them their own cultic deity called a Baal, B-A-A-L. And the Assyrians don't really care what happens after that. They just say, just fight amongst yourselves. We don't care, just as long as you don't bother us. And so that's what they do. They are at each other's throats, and they've got their own cultic deities. Well, as time goes on, each of those nations, which is worshiping their own Baal, their own fertility deities, and the remnant of Israelites that are still, the stragglers are still left living in the land, do what people tend to do. So they start to intermarry and to worship each other's gods. And this is why the southern kingdom of Judah, which preserves the worship of God alone, the God of Israel, despises Samaritans because they're seen as half-breeds, this ethnic mix, but also because they worship these other Baals in addition to the God of Israel. Well, here's the thing. Baal in Aramaic, which is the conversation, that's the language that Jesus is having his conversation with the Samaritan woman. Baal means Lord. It also means husband. So, once again, here's this nuptial note, because all of a sudden Jesus shows up, and at the literal level, this conversation is happening. It's talking about, you know, this woman and her, you know, her series of husbands that she's had. So Jesus is saying, you've already had five husbands, and the one you're with now is not your husband. So at the literal level, this conversation is, he's having a conversation with the Elizabeth Taylor of the ancient world. But John is never merely looking at these conversations at the literal level. So what's also being spoken here? Well, you've already had five Baals, says Jesus, and the one you're with now is not your Baal, is not your husband, is not your Lord. Who is the one she's with now? I mean, right now.
Pretty good.
Jesus. And in fact, when you go back into the prophetic tradition of Israel, God is constantly speaking of himself in these nuptial terms and speaking of the virgin daughter of Zion, who he, you know, he found, you know, laying in filth by the road, and he cleaned her up and made her his bride and so on and so forth. And so once again, you got this nuptial language going on. And so Jesus is the bridegroom that John the Baptist just finished talking about in the previous chapter. Jesus, the bridegroom, is, what's he doing? Well, he's proposing marriage to the woman of Samaria. Not this literal woman, but rather the Samaritan people.
Right.
And so, once again, nuptial language. And when you fast forward to the end of John's gospel, same deal. Jesus rides into Jerusalem on a donkey, which is emphatically a messianic act. The best illustration I've heard is, you know, imagine 4 years from now, you know, take your pick. Ted Cruz shows up at Valley Forge, you know, in a frock coat and a powdered wig and a tri-corner hat, and announces that he's running for president. Who would everybody understand him to be identifying himself with? Well, George Washington, of course. He's making an historical allusion. Jesus is doing exactly the same thing when he rides a donkey into Jerusalem. It's exactly the same thing that Solomon did when he entered on his reign 1,000 years before Christ. And Jesus expects everybody to understand that, and everybody does understand that, and the Pharisees get it too, which is why they tell him, tell this crowd to pipe down and stop calling you Son of David. He says, if they stop, the very stones will cry out.
Right.
That's what's going on there. What happens next, we will talk about in the next segment. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We'll be back with Rod Bennett right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. Hello, Rod. Oh, we may have lost Rod. Oh, well. Anyway, we'll get Rod back. We've been talking about apocalypses, that the apocalypse means unveiling, and it really has to do with the nuptial nature of the Catholic tradition. So we were talking in the last segment about this nuptial background to John's gospel. We were talking about the nuptial nature of John's gospel. Well, John's gospel climaxes with the entry of Jesus into Jerusalem and the passion. And Jesus is very, very carefully identifying himself as the Son of David, which is the great messianic title. That's why the crowd says Hosanna to the Son of David, and that's why Jesus doesn't rebuke them when they do it, because he really is claiming to be the Son of David, which is to say he's claiming to be the Messiah. Well, how does David enter on his reign? Well, in the Old Testament, when you read about the beginning of David's reign in the book of Samuel, what happens is after Saul dies, the first king of Israel, the elders of Israel come to David and they say, "We are flesh of your flesh and bone of your bone." Where have you heard that kind of language before in the Israelite tradition? Well, it turns out to be nuptial language, because it's the language, it's straight out of course the book of Genesis. It's the same language that's used to describe the relationship between Adam and Eve. This is how Eve is described, a bone of bone and flesh of flesh. And now Israel is speaking that way about its relationship to the king, and specifically to David the king. So when the Son of David appears, he's claiming to be Christ, a king. That's the charge. That's, if you're not clear on that, there's a big helpful sign over Jesus's head just 5 days later as he's hanging right on the cross. Who is Jesus? Jesus Nazarenus Rex Judaeorum. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And so he's not, when David becomes king, they're not asking him, "You seem to be a competent administrator of temple treasury funds. Could you be president of Israel?" They don't ask him to be president. They ask him to be king. And a king is father, husband, lord to his people who assume this feminine role. Just as in Scripture, the church assumes this feminine role in relationship to Christ the bridegroom. And so... at the climactic moment of John's gospel, as Jesus is hanging on the cross as the Son of David, John stops the action of his gospel. And after he's told us about the turning the water to wine and the healing of the centurion's or the official's son and, you know, the raising of Lazarus from the dead and the multiplication of the loaves and fishes and all these other amazing miracles. And John has never, ever done this in the rest of his gospel. He suddenly stops the action of his gospel and says, "I was there. I saw this with my own eyes. You have to believe that I saw this."
And they're like,
"What? Wow, it must have been really, what was it that you saw with your own eyes?" And John says, "The side of Christ was pierced, and from his side flowed blood and water." And it's like, really? That's that's what you want us to see, you know? Why is that the big focus? Well, it's not because John thought you might be interested in the medical details of pericardial rupture. The reason that that is the big deal for John is because this is the moment at which the bride is made from the side of the last Adam, as the first bride, Eve, was made from the side of the first Adam. Mm-hmm. What John sees there is not pericardial fluid. What John sees there is the waters of baptism.
Right. And he tells us that in his letter. So he says there are three witnesses, he says, the spirit, the water, and the blood. His mind is fleeting back to that moment when the side of Christ was pierced, when his heart was pierced, and from his side flowed blood and water. And this is the supreme moment at which the bride is born from the side of the last Adam. And that's why John, and John alone, he's the only one that mentions this. A lot of people forget this, that the other three Gospels don't mention this. John is the one that mentions that Mary was standing at the foot of the cross. And why? Well, because she's the icon of the bride. St. Ambrose says that Mary is the type of the church. And so if you want to understand this relationship between Christ the bridegroom and his bride, the church, look at that icon. Mary represents who we are in all of our redeemed perfection. She is without sin. What she is, we will be someday if we remain faithful to Christ. And so when we get to the book of Revelation, that's why Revelation is so nuptial, and that's why it climaxes in the marriage feast of the Lamb, because, once again, this is a Eucharistic reference, just like the wedding at Cana is a Eucharistic reference. And John sees all of that, and it's the final union at the end of time between Christ, the bridegroom, and his bride, the church, that is the fullness of the apocalypse. And so it's not a nuclear holocaust or there are going to be
revealing the revelation of what the whole story has been about all along.
Right. And so the church says, yeah, there are going to be great trials that the church faces. Absolutely. The church is actually going to face a trial, says the catechism, that will shake the faith of its members. Just as, because as Christ goes through the trial of the Passion, so the church has to go through that trial as well, and has been going through that trial, and will until the end of time. But that's all of that is not the fullness of the revelation. The fullness of the revelation is the marriage feast of the Lamb, and that's what we're ultimately talking about. So we're talking about good news, not something horrifying and awful that's going to result in nothing but death and destruction and the end of the world. So Bible study concluded.
Pretty good.
But
pretty good.
It's worth, though, talking about, I think, the way in which this Christian apprehension that time has an end and will conclude, and will involve us in the passion, death, and resurrection of Christ, gets played out in our art, too. So there's a ton of end-of-the-world movies. It's something that preoccupies the Western imagination. How will the world end? Will it end with a bang or a whimper? Is it going to blow up like Krypton?
I think it's related to... everybody says, well, gee, I don't know that I want to be around for the end of the world. Well, everybody's world ends. You may face it singly. The end of the world may come to you privately, or it may come to the whole world at the same time. But we're all facing the end of this world.
Sure.
And so any end of the world story is really, it seems to me, a meditation on our own date with destiny. And therein lies the power of it, I think. It causes us thinking about the four last things, you know, and that's what end of the world stories are good for, it seems to me.
Yeah, and I think that they challenge us to think about, you know, what really matters, and they come in so many different varieties. You know, I mean, this is I have a sort of an ongoing argument with Stephen Gerdanis because I'm kind of sick of superhero movies. It's like, okay, what about just normal people who don't have any powers? You know,
That's been done.
But superheroes, you know, what are they constantly doing? Well, they're constantly saving the world. which is by no coincidence. That's what Jesus does. You know, he actually saved
right.
the world.
Right. Yeah. Well, there you get Christ figures into the mix too when you bring in the Savior who prevents the end of all things, which the end of your life. So
right.
he saves your soul from death. It's I don't mean it goes back to the Apostle Peter who compares baptism to Noah's Ark, but really to the flood. In other words, we think the flood is the bad thing that comes in that story. No, actually, in the story, the flood waters are an image of cleansing.
Right.
In other words, the sin is being cleansed off the earth.
Right.
But cleansing isn't always cheap. There's a catharsis involved, you know. And so a lot of our end-of-the-world stories are about a fresh start, saving the world from something bad and getting a fresh start by having passed through the waters of baptism, if you see what I'm saying. Pass through the trial and come out the other end.
Yeah. And this is something that shows up constantly. Oh, it is the music. The music is playing. Okay, well, when we return, we'll take a look at some of the ends of the world, some of the different varieties of ends of the world that we have seen in our cinema and in our stories. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We'll be back in just a minute with Rod Bennett.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. We've talked a little bit about biblical apocalypse, and now we're talking about cinematic apocalypses. And, you know, there's been a lot of them, but one of the first big ones in the cinema was, go for it.
Well, yeah, it occurred to me during the break that a really great one is movie from the 50s, same producer that gave us the original War of the Worlds, movie called When Worlds Collide. I don't know how many of our audience have seen it or remember it, but it's about a rogue star entering the solar system and colliding with the Earth. And they see it, they detect the thing a year and a half out or whatever, and it's about efforts to build a Noah's Ark, basically. So and the movie opens with a quotation from the Bible and talks about Noah's Ark and all the rest of it. So the parallel is very deliberate and upfront. But, of course, there you've got a classic example of what we were talking about earlier, the sacramental aspect of end-of-the-world stories. What are they good for? In this particular case, the whole thing is an image of being saved by means of a Noah's Ark and getting a fresh start someplace else. And that myth, you know, has the whole essence of what baptism means in it. It's got baptism is being buried with Christ and being raised with him to walk in newness of life, as the scriptures say. And in When Worlds Collide, they make it to a new planet and get a fresh start on a completely new world. And it's a fun end of the world story.
Another end of the world story that predates that, except it's not about the end of our world. I mentioned earlier the explosion of Krypton.
Right.
In that story, of course, there is an ark, but it only saves one person, the baby whose name significantly is Kal-El.
Yeah. it's been noted before that that the creators of Superman, Siegel and Shuster, were Jews and not terribly practicing Jews, but steeped in Jewish stories and lore. And you know, when it came time to tell a story about a son coming down from heaven, they tapped into traditional Jewish motifs, which also happened to be traditional Christian motifs.
Right, right. And so you have, you know, they really played this up in the film, of course, where, you know, at one point Superman goes to his Fortress of Solitude and
conjures
up the
image. You're talking about the 70s film with Christopher Reeve, right?
Yeah, the 70s film, and he conjures up, you know, this image of his father who tells him, you know, I'm sending them you, my only son. You know?
Oh, my goodness. The scene where Marlon Brando puts him into the rocket at the beginning is even more explicit. It's I mean, it's pretty much a, I don't know if you'd call it a pastiche, but it's like John chapter 1. He's talking about the, you know, the son living on, the father living on in the son, and the son, being in the father and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
I mean, it gets
yeah.
very Trinitarian.
Yeah, yeah. And, that's a vision, of course, of the end of a world. And that, by the way, brings us to something else. Oh, we have a caller on the line. Hello, caller.
Oh,
there.
Oh, I think I recognize that laugh.
I recognize that voice.
Didn't Han Solo say that? I know that laugh.
Well, we're supposed to say, we're Kathleen.
Hi, fellas. How's it going?
Going
well. Kath, how are you?
I'm okay. I just wanted to call in and say, since you mentioned early one of your other, or your other listener, devoted listener, I just want to call in today and let you know. I've been trying to call in for a couple of weeks here, but you guys are just so interesting that a lot of the time I just let you talk. Not to say that today's not interesting, please. I just wanted to make sure you knew that too. But I had something that I wanted to share with you in regard to Rod's book.
Which one? There's so many.
It's been a really fascinating, a source of very, very interesting information and some dovetails to a project that I've been working on myself. You guys know that I'm a musician and a cantor for Catholic masses and things, and also singer-songwriter, but I wanted to let you know that there's a project that I've been working on that made for an interesting dovetail with the information in Rod's book, which is I was recruited by the good folks at divineoffice.org, which is a resource for folks who pray the Liturgy of the Hours.
Mm-hmm.
They found my music kind of floating out on the internet and contacted me and asked if I would contribute some music to the site, and so I've been learning more and more about the Liturgy of the Hours. I mean, this ancient form of devotion, but in my research, I discovered that none other than Saint Ambrose, who was of course living and working at the same time as St. Athanasius, who's the subject of your book, Rod. St. Ambrose is actually the author of a lot of the hymns that are in use even today for the Liturgy of the Hours. And St. Ambrose was very involved in trying to help shore up St. Athanasius and teaching the true faith against the Arians. Which I just found fascinating. And
pretty good.
So anyway, also just wanted to connect with you along the lines of today's topic, and since you mentioned my name 2 weeks ago during the show, I thought I should call in and say, yeah, because, our conversations and you're laying out the history of the church has been responsible for a lot of my own change in paradigm, which has been kind of one of those personal apocalypses, I guess, in terms of changing of worldview and my conversion to the whole faith of the Catholic Church. So I want to thank you again for, even though that one thing that you told me about finding and discovering the actual Christian holidays as opposed to the Jewish holidays did make me mad for probably like 3 days. I'm grateful for your grateful
you forgave
for your perseverance
me.
And your patience and your courage, I guess, in sharing that with me, because I can't imagine life without the church now. Because yeah.
Well,
my yeah. world
we're so glad you're
completely
here.
Changed.
God love you.
Anyway,
well, yeah.
So,
right.
So anyway,
very
I,
good,
I guess I'll call in maybe some other time and talk more about the Liturgy of the Hours and this cool connection with St. Ambrose. But anyway, just wanted to mention that and say, Excelsior, keep up the good work, and take care. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
good
you.
Nice to hear from you.
All right. Take care. Bye now.
Thank you. God love you, dear. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was fun.
Sweet lady.
Golly. Yes, she's great. All right. Well, that was Kathleen from Portland, who is a total stranger to me and certainly to you, right?
Does it really count as a caller if it's somebody that you know and been to your house 100 times? So.
Why not?
That's Kathy.
Dial tone there. Danny? Still getting the dial tone, Danny. That's
uh-oh.
Better.
Is she gone?
Right, I think she's gone. All right.
I think
well,
we're
anyway, we're running out of time here, but a couple of other end of the world films. One of the things that's been done like repeatedly has been the great Richard Matheson's story "I Am Legend," which keeps getting remade as
the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, I Am Legend. Let's see. There's the Omega Man. What's the one with Vincent Price? Is that called I Am Legend?
Last Man on Earth is the original, the first movie version of it. Predates even Night of the Living Dead, which is the sort of unofficial variation on it, an unofficial remake, which is the one that really got the zombie apocalypse genre going.
Yeah. It's interesting how the zombie thing has sort of evolved over time, you know. But
gone bananas, yeah.
The I Am Legend story is just over. Every time it's been done, it's been just milked for all of this Christological imagery and significance. So in the Omega Man, you know, you've got everybody's been turned into these sort of post-human nasty creatures who only come out at night and they drink your blood and so on and so forth. And there's the hero is the guy who has blood that somehow makes him immune to this awful thing that has transformed the rest of the human race.
Well, I think the Christological stuff got into it by way of Richard Matheson's original story, in which they're not zombies, they're vampires.
Right.
The original story was Richard Matheson trying to think, gee, is it possible that there could be a medical or physiological explanation for the vampire myth?
Rats, we're so out of time. Well,
and we're out of time.
Okay.
Oh, we'll do that next time.
Well, we'll talk about it next time. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Rod. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our producer today was Danny Head. And we will be back tomorrow with Doug O'Brien. Until then, have a great evening. Bye-bye.
So long, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.